You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by International Association of Firefighters Local 42 and Communications Workers Local 6360. The Greater Kansas City Firefighters, IAFF Local 42 of Kansas City, Missouri, representing fire, EMS, and public safety professionals in Greater Kansas City since 1918. And we mourn the loss of the two firefighters who died this week. Communications Workers Local 6360 stands for workers' rights, supports union-made products, and encourages you to buy them to help all of us keep good jobs. And we thank our underwriters for their support to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, some want to kick them out, others want to welcome them in. What are the candidates' positions on immigration and immigration reform? We'll find out on the show, and then on Pioneer Women, we interview Cindy Longacre. She's a woman of steel and an organizer. In the news, St. Louis minimum wage ordinance overturned by courts. Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Angie Williams. And now for the news.
And now for the news from our side. The St. Louis Labor Tribune reports that the Missouri Home Care Union launched a new initiative petition campaign to require that in-home care service providers and consumer-directed services vendors pay their home care attendants at least 85% of the fees that they receive from the state of Missouri for those services. Currently, the average pay for personal care aides in Missouri is only $9 an hour, and the 8,000 to 9,000 home care attendants in Missouri's Consumer Directed Services Program earn an average of $8.60 per hour. Yet, vendors in the state's Consumer Directed Home Care Program are paid $15.56 by the state for every hour of service provided. So, the average vendor pays out $8.60 per hour in wages and another $1.11 per hour in fringe costs and keeps for its own administrative cost and profit an average of $5.85 for every hour of service. That's 38% for each worker for each hour worked that will go to the vendor and not to patient care. The minimum wage for consumer-directed services attendants has not risen in 15 years, and the petition would allow the home care workers' earnings $8.50 to $9 an hour to get a $3 or $4 hourly raise, making a real difference in their lives. Missouri home care workers are a part of a nationwide effort of low-wage workers to earn a living wage, and they are also demanding the right to unionize, and some are doing so. But some of the providers are also refusing to comply with the law. The Missouri Home Care Union launched a campaign with signature gathering drives in St. Louis and Kansas City this week, and they'll expand to other parts of the state throughout the fall. Signatures are due to be submitted to the Missouri Secretary of State by May of 2016.
Get this. PAI reports that OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, wants to hold joint employers, think McDonald's headquarters and local McDonald's restaurants, more responsible for job safety and health violations. The issue is important for millions of workers nationwide employed by franchise holders, such as local outlets of national fast food and motel chains, but whose wage scales, working conditions, and even uniforms are set by the chain's corporate headquarters. A few months ago, organizations like Stand Up KC, who fight for $15 and a union for Kansas City fast food workers, called attention to safety issues. Complaints came in from other cities, and now OSHA is investigating burning grease and injured workers at 19 McDonald's outlets in New Orleans, Philadelphia, and elsewhere. OSHA spokeswoman Laura McGinnis said, "There are many different work arrangements, including temporary workers, subcontractors, and franchising arrangements that could be considered joint employers." An OSHA memo adds that while the franchisor and the franchisee may appear to be separate and independent employers, a joint employer standard may apply where the corporate entity exercises direct or indirect control over working conditions, has the unexercised potential to control working conditions, or based on the economic realities. That includes whether the franchise holder can implement its own job safety and health programs, or whether it must use what the corporate headquarters promulgates, and whether the franchise holder must report injuries and hazards to that headquarters.
The St. Louis Post-Dispatch reports that yesterday a circuit judge struck down the city's minimum wage law just hours before it was set to go into force. Circuit Judge Stephen Omar declared it was void and out of step with state law. The city quickly said it would appeal to a higher court. A consortium of groups, including Missouri Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Missouri, sued last month in an attempt to stop the minimum wage increase to $11 by 2018. And Omer agreed, saying the city's law was unenforceable and in conflict with current state law that sets the minimum wage at $7.65. The city argued that the increase was proper and also cited social issues from Ferguson unrest as a reason for implementing it. Omer said it was the court's duty to determine the validity of the ordinance without considering the social or economic effect of its enforcement. Mayor Francis Slay vowed to appeal Omer's ruling. Richard Von Glahn of Missouri Jobs with Justice, which had strongly backed the minimum wage increase, said, "The increase passed by the Board of Aldermen in St. Louis reflects a growing consensus that the crisis of poverty wages needs to be addressed at every level in our economy, and we thank the city's elected officials for their continued leadership on this." Tonight's readers were Beth Pike, Ariana Eckel, and I'm Molly Madden.
About a year ago, I set out on the road, seeking my fame and fortune, looking for a pot of gold. Things got bad and things got worse, I guess you know the tune. Oh Lord, stuck in a low die again.
Hi, I'm Jake White, and you are listening to Heartland Labor Forum on KKFI. Joining me today is Professor Kathy Olmsted. Dr. Olmsted is a scholar of political and cultural history of the United States 20th century. Her new book is Right Out of California, The 1930s and the Big Business Roots of Modern Conservatism. She is chair of the history department at University of California at Davis. Dr. Olmsted, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course.
Okay, so talking about some recent events, during Tuesday's debates, all the Democratic Party candidates pledged their support for executive action, and Republicans in the House are adamantly opposed. Chairman Representative Bob Goodlatte of Virginia, for instance, a Republican called DAPA, which defers deportation for parents of U.S. citizens or lawful residents, quote, "one of the biggest constitutional power grabs ever." And Representative Trent Franks from Arizona said, quote, "there are a few things the president can do that are more dangerous." So can right-wing fears about executive action be traced back to the 1930s? And what type of executive actions did big business leaders fear?
Well, I think big business leaders don't fear all executive actions, just executive actions that they feel harm their interests. So prior to the 1930s, for example, you had a lot of corporate leaders in America who were very much in favor of a large state. they were pro-government because the government did many things that helped them. It helped to build the railroads, and it expanded their markets, and it helped to control labor and immigration. It would send in troops to put down strikes. And so businessmen were not generally anti-government. But then in the 1930s, you had this shift when Franklin Roosevelt became president, and he said that, yes, government would continue to serve big business, but also it would begin to serve labor, because his recovery program for the United States to get out of the Depression depended on workers being able to form unions so that they could collectively bargain and raise their wages. So it's when the government began passing these labor laws and protecting the rights of workers that a lot of conservative businessmen began to turn against the government and began to develop a more anti-statist ideology.
During the debate, just staying with current events for a minute, Senator Sanders was questioned about his voting record on immigration. And while he did vote for the 2013 Senate Immigration Reform Bill, some have questioned his vote against immigration reform in 2007. Sanders explained that the vote was due to his concerns around guest worker programs and potential worker exploitation. Quote from Senator Sanders, "Guest workers are coming in, they're working under terrible conditions, but if they stand up for their rights, they're thrown out of the country." Unquote. Sanders went on to affirm his commitment to a comprehensive approach to fixing the immigration system as well as a pathway to citizenship. So what were conditions like for guest workers in California in the 1930s, and how much does race have to do with guest worker conditions?
Well, in the 1930s, they didn't have guest worker programs, but they began to have guest worker programs during World War II. But in the 1930s, there was a labor surplus, and so there were actually, the government was helping to deport workers rather than bringing in more. So in the 1930s, because there were so many workers, way more than there were jobs, the wages were very low and the conditions were very poor. So, for example, in California's fields, there were people working for as little as 10 cents an hour, which at the time could buy you food and maybe gas to get to the next job, but nothing else. And so even children were forced to work. So then during World War II, when the farm workers then were sort of sucked into the cities to work in the defense plants, that's when the U.S. government began the Bracero program and started bringing in guest workers from Mexico. And that's, of course, when you get a different kind of exploitation of workers, because they're not citizens and they're not here permanently, and so they're particularly vulnerable to exploitation by their employers.
Mm-hmm. And so in your book, you mention how, I guess, business interests and their associated newspapers would sometimes blame tensions on, quote, agitators from New York. And so what did this term imply, and how did the idea of people coming from Europe and bringing crazy ideas impact immigration policy in the 1930s?
Well, the 1930s, well, the 1920s to the 1960s is a time when the U.S. had the least immigration in its history, mm-hmm. because in the 1920s, the U.S. passed these very draconian restrictions on immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe. And so as a result, you had this 40-year period when immigration steadily declined, and immigrants did not play that great a role in American politics or society. Now, in the 1930s, these mostly native-born Americans who were organizing labor unions in California were often communists, not just like accused of being communists, but were actual communists. And this was very anxiety-inducing for a lot of the businessmen who were worried that we could have a Bolshevik revolution here in the United States. And so when they're talking about outside agitators, usually they're talking about communists, but especially when they use terms like the agitator from New York, this was a code word for Jew. And there was a lot of anti-Semitism as well as racism in the rhetoric that was and the violence that was directed against labor organizers in the 1930s.
And some of that also, most of it came from the private security firms, or was some of that from the state also?
It was both. Not the federal state, but from the California Highway Patrol on the state level, mm-hmm. and then also police officers and sheriffs on the local level often were used to go in and arrest people for picketing, and also to sometimes to employ force. Then in addition to the law enforcement officers, there were vigilantes who were hired or encouraged by the growers, in the case of the agricultural strikes in California, to go in and beat up the strikers and break the strikes.
And this is a part of popular culture. I mean, it's come into American memory through, or you claim a lot from your book that the artists and writers colony in Carmel, California, really influenced how people thought about the organizing taking place among farm workers. And in particular, you talk about John Steinbeck and his role in telling these stories. And you also mention what's missing from Steinbeck's stories. So could you walk us through some of the history of the Carmel colony?
Sure. There were a lot of artists and writers in Carmel in the 1930s. Carmel is this beautiful little town on the coast, about 150 miles south of San Francisco. And it's rather remote from urban areas, and there wasn't a good road connecting it to the urban areas until the mid-1930s. So it was a pretty isolated area, and it was a place where a lot of artists decided that they could go and think and be in isolation, except they could socialize with their other artist and writer friends, and thus create great art. So you had this very small town in California that became this haven for artists and writers. And many of them became interested in, engaged with the struggle for farm worker rights in California in the 1930s. They heard about farm worker strikes in their area, and so they organized expeditions to go to the strike areas and give money to the farm workers, but also to then try to bring the attention of the rest of America to those fields and to let urban Americans know what was happening in rural America. And they did this by writing stories and poems for publications like The Nation and The New Republic, by publishing novels and doing sculptures and paintings. And the most famous of all of these artists and writers was John Steinbeck, who did a lot of research for his novels. His first strike novel was In Dubious Battle, which he researched in 1934 and published in 1936. And this is going to be a movie, I guess, coming out next year with James Franco. Uh-huh. But it was Steinbeck's first strike novel, and he actually interviewed some of the strike leaders of the big cotton strike in California in 1934. And got his information that way. And so after he did these interviews, he decided to write a novel about the great strikes in California. But in translating it into fiction, what he decided to do was to make all of the workers and their leaders white men. And this really wasn't at all the case in California in the 1930s. A lot of the strike leaders were women. A lot of the participants were women. And also, it was a very ethnically and racially diverse labor force. And in particular, the cotton strike of 1933, whose leaders he interviewed, was composed of about 90% Mexican strikers. So by telling the story of the strikers, but then changing all the characters to white men, he's given us sort of a very vivid idea of what these strikes were like in the 1930s. So we can really picture the violence, for example. But he really gives us this idea that it was entirely a struggle of white men, when really it was a much more diverse affair, and therefore much more threatening to the powers that be.
And you also point to Langston Hughes as someone who was there who maybe gives a more well-rounded version. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Langston Hughes was there for a year, bizarrely enough, because he was very much an urban African-American. But he had this patron who had a house in Carmel who said, here, well, I'll put you up for a year and pay for your groceries and your houseboy and give you a German shepherd and the run of the place, and you can just really create great art by living in my house for a year. And so Langston Hughes agreed to do that. And so that's how he was caught up in the crusade by the artists and writers in Carmel to save the farm workers or help the farm workers. And so he learned a lot about this, and with a fellow writer in Carmel, he co-wrote a script for a play about the farm workers, which showed that they had female leaders and that they were very ethnically diverse, and focused very closely on the ethnic and racial tensions among the strikers. Yet he couldn't find a producer for that. So the script exists, and you can read it, but it's never been performed.
And another fascinating part of your book was talking about how the organizers were able to promote racial equality, especially among the Okies, who weren't necessarily, it wasn't their first priority. And one of the stories that you tell was about trying to integrate the dinner tables. And could you recount that for us?
Yeah. So when there was this massive cotton strike in California, in California Central Valley, in the fall of 1933, that involved about 18,000 farm workers. And so they all agreed to stop picking in order to get a higher wage. And they the growers, once the strike began, the growers evicted the strikers from their property because the strikers had been, camping out on grower property. And so they evicted them, and the strikers responded by making strike camps on land that was given by sympathetic small growers. So you had these massive strike camps where, say, 5,000 pickers lived, in their cars, in their tents, in this little city that they built. But the Okies, coming from the Southwest in a very segregated society and having distinct ideas about white supremacy, did not want to eat with the Mexican or African-American farm workers. And so they had segregated areas in the dining area. And the dining area is a glamorous way to say they had these tables set up. But they were all racially segregated. And the strike leaders realized that this was a real impediment to success, as having the workers divided on ethnic and racial lines. So what they did is they appointed a leader of each ethnic group, and then they set up a leader's table in the front where all of the leaders, the Filipinos, the leader of the Filipinos, and the African-Americans, and the Mexicans, and the Okies, all would eat together, so that they set this example for the rest of the workers. And gradually, over the course of the strike, some of those racial barriers began to break down.
We're talking to Dr. Kathy Olmsted. She's the author of a new book, Right Out of California, The 1930s and the Big Business Roots of Modern Conservatism. Wanted to talk a bit about big business modern conservatism that's been in the news, Mr. Donald Trump. And I wanted to just mention something that he said yesterday, which was, quote, "I watched Hillary last night. We're going to give this, we're going to give that," said Trump. "The poor woman, she's got to give everything away because this maniac that was standing on her right is giving everything away. So she's following. That's what's happening. This socialist slash communist." He told the audience Sanders would, quote, "tax you people at 90% and take everything." And he also said, "nobody heard the term communist, but you know what, I call him a socialist slash communist, okay? Because that's what he is," Trump said. How much do you think Trump is playing back to this sort of big business rhetoric that came out of California in the 1930s?
Wow, that's really interesting. I had not heard that. Well, yes, that's exactly the technique that they would use in the 1930s, is they would call the liberal socialists and the socialist communists, and essentially associate the center with the left, even when the center was trying to distance itself from the left. And no matter, it didn't matter what the centrists did to try to prove that they were just as anti-communist as the right, it didn't matter that people on the right were always saying, aha, you're radicals, you're reds, you're communist. Mm-hmm. And that was certainly, you know, the technique that a lot of the business leaders and the newspapers used in associating the Roosevelt administration with communism.
And the this was something, maybe I was just picking this out of your book and not fully understanding it, but going back to the Steinbeck thing, because I think a lot of what Trump and Sanders are debating is kind of about the New Deal. But I think in your book you make the case that the way that Steinbeck portrays the characters in his book actually kind of influenced who got to be included in the New Deal and who didn't. And also, if you could just touch on for a second the agriculture workers not being included in the New Deal.
Yes. So Roosevelt did not call himself a socialist or consider himself a socialist at all. So he would consider himself far to the right of Bernie Sanders. But what he did want to do was help the economy recover and sort of reform capitalism so that it would work. And so one of his strategies was to protect the right of workers to organize unions, because his belief was, and this was also the belief of John Maynard Keynes and a lot of economists, was that if you allowed workers to form unions, then they could use that collective bargaining power to increase their wages. And if they increased their wages, then they could increase their spending. And then if they spent more, the economy would recover. So it was a form of redistribution of income, but instead of the state, you know, giving the dole to people, instead, it encouraged workers to use their collective bargaining power to increase their wages. However, Roosevelt excluded agricultural workers at the beginning from this protection that he gave to labor unions. He deliberately interpreted the law so that it only included industrial workers, not agricultural workers. And the reason that he did that was an important part of his coalition were Southern Democrats. And the Southern Democrats had a lot of power in Congress. They had a lot of sharecroppers who they did not want to unionize. And so to make sure that the Southerners voted for New Deal laws, Roosevelt said, okay, I will just make it for industrial workers and not for your sharecroppers. And though he was really focused on the South in doing this, it also affected California, because the exclusion for agricultural workers affected not only the South but also the West. So the agricultural workers did not have the same protection that industrial workers did. But in California, they didn't know that. All they knew is that they heard all of this about all of the great strikes and the president wants you to join a union. So they were inspired to form unions, even though the government wasn't explicitly giving them protection to do so.
I see. And so they were... is that still the situation? I mean, we have just a very short amount of time left, but I'm curious how much conditions have changed for agriculture workers in California today. We hear a lot about the environmental issues, but how are labor conditions?
Well, labor conditions, in brief, are better, but you know they're still not great. California and Hawaii both have state laws that give agricultural workers the right to join a union. There's still no national law, but there are these state laws. And as a result, you have in California United Farm Workers that, you know, has negotiated some important contracts, and wages and conditions have improved definitely since the 1960s, let alone the 1930s. There's still a long way to go, though.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us today. That was Kathy Olmsted. She's the author of a new book, Right Out of California, The 1930s and the Big Business Roots of Modern Conservatism. I'm Jake White. You're listening to Heartland Labor Forum. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
From banning fracking to protecting the rights of Mother Earth, women employ many tactics for advocating for the planet. Find out more on Wings, Saturday at 2:30.
This retired federal employee Bill Claus encouraging all my federal employee friends to please consider supporting KKFI during this year's combined federal campaign. That's CFC code 21994. Just a few dollars a week on payroll deductions won't mean much to you, but it'll mean big bucks to us at KKFI. So please consider supporting KKFI. That's agency code 21994.
This is Susan Sanders bringing you another episode of Pioneer Women here at Heartland Labor Forum. As you know, on the Pioneer Women series, we showcase a woman who is doing a job that's typically considered men's work. On tonight's show, we have Cindy Longacre, who works for the Steelworkers Union 27.
Yes.
And I want to welcome you, Cindy, to our show.
Thank you, Susan.
Well, Cindy, tell our listeners exactly what it is you do for the Steelworkers Union. My understanding is that you try to create a union for workers where there isn't a union in place. Is that
Yes, Susan,
the case?
That's exactly
okay.
What it is. We are considered organizers.
Organizers,
yes.
All right. Is that kind of like Norma Rae in that movie years ago where she was working in this place? In
yes.
A factory, and this man comes down from the north and wants to organize a union, and she's all for it.
Yes.
Is that kind of like what you're doing?
That I would be considered the man that's coming down from the north.
Okay. And how do you go about organizing?
We have a employee from that business
mm-hmm.
that calls our international office.
Yeah.
And then our international contacts us.
Uh-huh.
And we start making phone calls, setting up meetings, and we have to determine whether or not there's even an organizing campaign. So after uh-huh. meetings and talking with the employees, we make our determination on if there's a campaign.
Now, by campaign, do you mean you want to know if the employees really want a union there?
Yes, and what their issues are.
Okay.
Some of their issues may be able to be dealt with through other entities such as OSHA
uh-huh.
or other outside sources.
Okay. Well, in this political climate now of what seems to be anti-union sentiment, is your job more difficult?
Yes, it is.
And why do you think there is this trend?
Because the big corporations have the money to pay off our politicians.
Yeah.
And once you go union, the corporation has less control over your wages and your working conditions.
Okay. Well, do workers understand this?
When they call us, we explain all of that to them.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, let's say I was a caller and I said, I'm working for this factory and I'm going in every day and I don't like my supervisor and I feel like I'm just a sitting duck. What can you do for me?
Well, the first question I would ask you is, what are your working conditions like? Is
mm-hmm.
this just a personal issue you're having with your supervisor?
Mm-hmm.
Are you being treated unfairly or differently than other employees that you work with?
Mm-hmm.
How are your regular raises? Do you get regular raises?
Mm-hmm.
We'd ask you a whole series of different questions. But most of the time when people call us,
mm-hmm.
they do 75% of the talking and we do 25% of the listening. You know, we answer their questions, and they give us all the information.
Well, I understand right now in Kansas City, you're working on two different places at once.
Yes, ma'am.
I know you don't want to give away where these places are, but can you explain some of the issues involved?
One of the places that we are organizing right now. They're government contractors.
Uh-huh.
And one site is in Missouri. The other site is in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
The site that's in Kansas is Right to Work.
Okay.
Which means if they do vote the union into their workplace,
uh-huh.
they don't have to pay union dues in order to get union representation.
That seems like
a little unfair.
Yeah.
But a majority of the time when you do represent someone that doesn't pay union dues,
mm-hmm.
if it comes out in their favor, they end up paying those union dues because then they realize just how important the union really is to them.
So it's not a law that Right to Work would prevent these employees from paying the union dues.
Right.
Okay, so, but it makes it more, I'm trying to understand, the workers would make the decision whether or not they're going to pay those dues?
Yes.
Okay.
And it makes it more financially difficult to get representation when not all the members are paying their union dues, because that's what their union dues go for.
Is to pay for people to come in and sort of lobby their position.
Yes, and represent them, yes.
Okay, I think I'm getting it. All
Among
right.
other things, but
sure.
that's like the most important reason why people pay union dues.
Well, and so you told me recently that your role as a union creator is not often performed by women.
No.
That this is where the pioneer women concept comes in. You're actually doing what's considered a man's job.
Yes, back in the day, it was just such, it was so violent.
Really?
You know, fights would break out, people's tires would get slashed, windows broken. There have actually been deaths because of union organizing.
Really?
So it was predominantly men.
I see. And so when you began, how long have you been doing this work?
This is actually my second campaign
yeah.
that I've worked on. I mm-hmm. have been getting educated and getting the training I need for years to be able to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But I hold other positions in our local union as well.
So then having you do this job, your superiors, well, I know they're not superiors, they're leaders
right.
in the union, thought you were the person for the job.
Yes.
Okay. And you kind of broke the glass ceiling.
Well, I hope so.
Okay.
I hope so.
Are
we
you...
have a few women out there organizing throughout the country, but not near as many as we do have our male counterparts.
Would you say you're paid the same wage that the men organizers are paid?
When you come out mm-hmm. off your job site to organize, you're considered a casual.
Yes.
So I'm getting paid my lost time, which is what I would have been making if I was working at my regular job.
Yes.
Until I go to work for the international.
Uh-huh.
Then it's pay raise benefits and all of that sorts. And I would hope, being union,
uh-huh.
that we would get the same amount of pay as our counterparts do.
So then when you organize, you're not in the regular union work?
No, I'm in the regular union work.
Okay.
I'm just getting paid my lost time because I'm not actually an employee of the international union. I'm just working for them right now.
All right. So it's sort of like a special contract
yes.
you have?
Yes.
Okay. And when you take that contract, you're paid for the lost wages from your regular union job?
Yes, or
okay.
any benefits or anything like that that I would be missing out
on. I understand. Okay. And you're hoping that it's the same amount the men organizers would be receiving?
Yes, if they were making the same amount of wages I was making at my job site.
Mm-hmm.
But my goal is to work for the international full time.
I see.
So once I work for the international full time, uh-huh. I would think we're union, we're all in this together, that I would be making the same amount of money because that's what unions are all about.
Right. Okay. Well, can you share an experience you had where you were afraid?
This morning, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
We
what
are
happened?
Organizing a company down off of I-435 and Front Street in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And it was dark. We got out there about 5:30 this morning
mm-hmm.
and standing out in the middle of the road, passing out flyers, kind of leery about getting hit by vehicles going in the other direction. Uh-huh. And we had a couple security guards asking us to leave. And we left for a minute and then parked elsewhere and then walked back.
Yeah.
And was approached by them again. It gets a little leery, especially when you can't see them coming.
So
we were afraid of being arrested is what we were afraid of.
Were the security police part of the corporation staff?
Yes.
I see. So it is like that film, Normal Ray.
Yeah, it can be at times. Yes, ma'am.
Well, now, you're in the Steelworkers Union.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When you first started out, were you using a hammer on steel, or were you lifting steel beams, or what'd you start doing?
No, actually, the steel workers are more than just steel workers.
Mm-hmm.
I work for a government contract company.
Okay.
So I'm considered a file clerk.
Okay.
Now, I can't tell you everything that I do because I have a Homeland Security background security clearance. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the stuff that we do, we can't share.
Mm-hmm.
But I work with paper and I work with files, and the steelworkers are more than just steelworkers.
Mm-hmm.
We have joined together with other unions. So it's PACE, we have electrical workers, we have medical, we have nurses in our union. Mm-hmm. It's just a huge variety of workplaces.
You mean a nurse in a hospital mm-hmm. could be a member of the steelworkers
yes,
union?
Yes, ma'am. We have hospitals. Yes, ma'am.
That is just mind-blowing.
Yes.
Okay. Well, you're educating me, I'll tell you. Okay, so then as you got into this particular union and you were maybe thinking about being an organizer, or was there a mentor that somebody you admired that you wanted to do what they were doing? What brought you into that?
We organized twice. The very first time we organized, I was anti-union.
Really?
Yes. Uh-huh. The second time we organized, there was a new organizer that came in, and I think that he did a much better job educating and explaining things, and his name is Dan Fichter,
uh-huh.
and he has been my mentor probably for about the past 9-10 years.
Yeah.
I am where I'm at today because of him.
Wow. So tell me, what was it that impressed you?
He was able to make me see the facts for myself instead mm-hmm. of just hounding them into me.
Mm-hmm.
He made me learn things on my own, and he made me question myself.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't go, I don't know, you don't really educate yourself if you don't question.
Right.
You know, I don't know if that makes sense.
Uh-huh.
But Dan has opened so many doors for me to be able to explore so many different aspects of the union, and they do more than just the political stuff, which is what I thought that the unions were all about.
Well, when you were in the mindset that you were anti-union, you weren't in the Steelworkers Union, were you?
Not yet, no.
Okay, so
they were trying to organize our plant.
So what was your mindset then?
Well, my sister was management,
mm-hmm.
and I was a single mom. Mm-hmm. I had just found this job working days. I didn't have to work evenings or weekends or find daycare for my kids.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to rock that boat. Mm-hmm. And it was the first job I had ever had, making more than $10 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So I really didn't want to rock that boat. And mm-hmm. I sat and I listened to what management and the union busters had to say.
Mm-hmm.
And I believed it.
I see. So then I would think that experience of your converting
mm-hmm.
would help you be a better organizer, because you'd understand the mindset of the people who might be leery, and then you could address those concerns.
It has educated me.
Yeah. All right. Well, is there an experience, Cindy, that you've had where you really felt victorious?
Oh, goodness. The experiences that I have where I feel victorious are almost every single day, to be honest with
really?
You. We just negotiated the best contract we have ever had.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that doesn't just benefit me. It benefits everybody at my plant.
Yeah.
And now we're in the process of organizing others that do the exact same thing that we do.
Yeah.
So they're going to be able to have contracts also that will help with their health and safety, their getting raises every year, and anything else that's major concerns for them at their plant. Mm-hmm. I feel victorious every single day. Even when something disappoints me, I know that tomorrow it's going to be something that we get past or we get done that's going to outweigh any disappointments we could ever have.
So then it sounds like you get an affirmation every day on the job that on the right track.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Was there ever an experience where you had second thoughts about maybe?
I might say that must be every day also.
Okay.
When you go in to represent someone and you don't feel that their discipline is warranted, mm-hmm. and the avenues that you take just aren't panning out for you,
mm-hmm.
that's a huge disappointment. Or when someone gets terminated and you have exhausted all of your resources to get their job back.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's good and bad, I think, with everything that you do.
Right. And so you know that you're doing the best that you can.
Always.
That the position that you're in gives you an opportunity to do the best that you can. But sometimes fate has a different outcome for you.
Right.
All right. Well, let me see. Is there any question I haven't asked you, Cindy, that you think maybe our listeners ought to know about your work?
That it's not all political. A lot of the feedback that we get from people that are against unions mm-hmm. is because they think it's all about politics, and that's what all of their union dues go for.
Uh-huh.
And that's only just a drop in the hat.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you, Cindy, for coming to the Heartland Labor Forum and being on our Pioneer Women series. I think that you have a lot of zest for the work that you're doing, and it comes across as we're sitting here talking. And I want to remind our listeners something I've often said. You know, sometimes the best man for the job is a woman.
Is a woman.
Yeah. So, Heartland Labor Forum listeners, stay tuned. There's more to come.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up. Fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that Peter is gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on,
get up.
Good evening, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams from the law offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Today I thought I'd talk a little bit in light of the recent Democratic debate and the very recent several Republican debates, a little bit about what to look for when you're looking at the candidates as we're coming up on our election season. Specifically, I want to talk tonight about what to look for when assessing the candidate's position on immigration. One thing that I've noticed, and this many of the candidates are guilty of this, is that the candidates like to use sort of bumper sticker phrases or slogans when they talk about immigration. They like to say stuff like get in line or do it right or secure the borders. And these are all the things that I'm going to do. I'm going to make people get in line. I'm going to secure our borders. But these slogans are really just empty words and phrases that don't offer any real plan or say really how they're going to do any of these things. The fact is that right now we spend more on border security on our southern border than we ever have in the history of of ever. We deport more people than ever, and our undocumented population has been at a zero net growth by all counts for the last several years, meaning that they are removing about the same number of people that are actually getting in because of our tightened border security. So we're not adding any to our undocumented population. The fact is that immigration is an excessively complicated and complex issue. The plan for immigration that many candidates discuss only discusses border security, and any plan that only discusses border security is unrealistic as it is incomplete. Any border security, but especially any border in any country, but especially one as large as ours in the north and in the south, is never going to be 100% secure, and that's just a fact. It's not like we're a nightclub where we have a door and there's a bouncer and we can let one person in and one person out. Our borders don't work like that. And that's just talking about our physical land border. That doesn't count airports and seaports and all the people, the thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of people that come in and out of our country every day on airplanes, on ships, on land, doing just normal business for normal things that everybody does every day. Setting up any kind of immigration plan that depends on 100% secure border as a condition to future reform, or even as the only element of reform, dangerously ignores the problems that we have with our system that we have right now. The fact is, the system that we have is old, it's outdated, and it was built in a time when international calls and international travel were difficult and were expensive and were really reserved for rich people. It did not contemplate a world that we live in now, where you can fly from one end of the globe to the other for a couple $1,000s. And it certainly did not contemplate things like the internet, where we have the whole world literally in our pockets and our cell phones at any given time, and where any business, no matter how small, can be an international business. We need a reform for this age. So when you're listening to these candidates, do more than just listen to their slogans. Look behind their slogans and look at their platforms. Get on their website. See what their actual platforms are. See if their platforms talk more about, or not just security, but talk about family, talk about business, talk about protecting workers and their rights, talk about global humanitarian crises and how we're going to deal with that, talk about how we're going to deal with the fluid global travel that we have. We also need to recognize that there is not a one-size-fits-all solution to immigration. The needs that we have for businesses is not the same needs that we may have for students. It's also the solution that we have for the 11 million undocumented people that we have currently living in our country, many of whom, in fact, most of whom have been living here for more than close to 10 years, some of them more, many more, is not the same solution that we have or that we need for the people that are recently arriving fleeing violence in Central America. It may not, the solution for the people fleeing violence from Central America may not even be the same solution that we need from people fleeing violence in other parts of the world. All of these issues need to be looked at separately. When you're listening to the candidates, please listen to more than just their slogans. This is actually good advice for any issue. Look behind what they're saying. Look past their flashy phrases, because all these are doing is meant to excite and inflame people. Look at their plan. Do they have a plan that is more than securing our borders? How are they going to balance the need of the business with the need to protect workers from exploitation and abuse? How are they going to protect people who have been living here for many years? What are they going to do with Dreamers? What are they going to do with asylum seekers? How is this going to be implemented? Look for facts. That's the only way that we are going to start electing better people to represent us. It's the only way. If we as voters are better informed, look for facts, demand concrete plans, and demand more than just slogans. That's all I have for tonight. That's all I have. You can find me on the web at www.williamslawkc.com. Thank you very much for listening tonight. Have a great night and be safe.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for October 8th, 2015. The second annual community forum on gun violence, October 12th, the Kauffman Conference Center, 4801 Rock Hill, KCMO. Online registration only at gunviolencepublichealthissue.eventbrite.com. The Missouri Kansas City Committee to Protect Pensions, which is concerned about the Teamsters Central States Pension Fund Rally, Saturday, October 17th, 3 p.m., J.C. Nichols Fountain, 47th and Main. What's happening in Missouri Corrections? Empower Missouri's First Friday Lunch, Friday, November 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Westport Flea Market, 817 Westport Road, back room. Fast Food Worker Mobilization, Save the KC Minimum Wage, Tuesday, November 12th, 5:30 p.m., Barney Ellis Plaza, 12th and Wyandotte, KCMO. Check out our Heartland Labor Forum schedule at www.heartlandlaborforum.org.
And that's Tuesday, November 10th, not 12th, for that fast food demonstration. My mistake. This is Judy Ansel, and I want to tell you to tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. We've got an exclusive interview with Ai-Jen Poo, who's written a book called Age of Dignity, which asks the question, who is going to care for all of the baby boomers as they age, and what kind of working conditions are they going to have? And then we're also going to be talking about Familias Unidas, which is a farm worker organization which is taking on Driscoll, you know, the folks who bring you your strawberries. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.